Welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get in what I'm getting on. We're going to talk about what I'm reading about, and we are going to break it down. So, without further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Andrew Bilt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. It is so good to be back. And the first two articles we are going to talk about today are bone-breaking, earth-shattering, if you know what I mean. And the first article is in JAMA Internal Medicine, Serial Bone Density Measurements and Incident Fracture Risk Discrimination in Postmenopausal Women. The objective of this study was to assess whether a second bone mineral density measurement approximately 3 years after the initial assessment is associated with improved ability to estimate fracture risk beyond the baseline bone mineral density measurement alone. So basically, they're saying, hey, if we did a DEXA scam, I know it's scan, but it should stand for scam. If we did a DEXA scam 3 years after the first one, did it help tell us, did it give us the information we needed to know, which is what individual is going to break their hip or break their arm or break their back or fall and break a bone? Well, in this prospective observational study of over 7,000 women from the Women's Health Initiative with a mean follow-up of 12.1 years, they looked at quite a few different outcomes, which were things like the major osteoporotic fracture, things like hip fracture, clinical spine fracture, forearm fracture, shoulder fracture, the baseline bone mineral density, and the absolute change in the bone mineral density. All these things were assessed, and the results were a second bone mineral density assessment approximately 3 years after the initial bone mineral density measurement, or after the initial DEXA scam, was absolutely not associated with an improved risk discrimination beyond the initial bone mineral density assessment between women who did and did not experience hip fracture or major osteoporotic fracture. Here's why I hate this article. Well, first of all, let me say what I like about this article. I love that this article tells us exactly what we already knew. If you get one DEXA scan, that's probably realistically enough for their life in a majority of women, unless they're taking ridiculous amounts of steroids for severe COPD, but then you got other issues like severe COPD. But I hate that it adds absolutely nothing. You see, the USPSTF came out in 2018 and they said in their guidelines that were titled Screening for Osteoporosis to Prevent Fractures, US Preventative Services Task Force Recommendation Statement. They said, and I quote, here you go, however, limited evidence from two good quality studies found no benefit in predicting fractures from repeating bone measurements testing 4 to 8 years after initial screening. Whoa. You mean to tell me, Andrew, that we've already known that you don't have to do a repeat DEXA scan at least until 8 years, because we already have good studies saying we don't have to do it at least every once in every 8 years? Yep, exactly. And if you look at other observational data out there, I mean, we can easily push this 10, 12 years. So if you're going to do the trial that we all want to see, and that is follow up for an average of 12 15 years, 20 years later, or don't do the trial at all. You're just wasting our time, you're wasting money, and you're wasting patients' time doing the tests, doing the procedures, the follow-ups. Do it right or don't do it at all. On to the next article, which happens to also be another bone-breaking article. This one's in New England Journal of Medicine titled Atypical Femur Fracture Risk Versus Fragility Fracture Prevention with Bisphosphonates. In this study, almost 2,000 women 50 years of age or older who were receiving bisphosphonates and who were enrolled in the Kaiser Permanente healthcare system were followed from 2007 to 2017. The primary outcome was atypical femur fractures, usually defined as a fracture in the subtrochanteric region. Overall, there were 277 atypical femur fractures. And the longer that you were on a bisphosphonate, the more likely you were to develop an atypical femur fracture. At 3 to 5 years, your hazard ratio was right around 8, but it shot up to a hazard ratio of 43 for 8 years. This is likely why the guidelines I just mentioned, by the way, the guidelines I was just talking about from the USPSTF, they come out and say, at 5 years, you should probably take a drug holiday. At 5 years, you should probably reevaluate the situation and say, does this patient really need it? Because your risk goes up astronomically as you're on these medications longer. And 5 years, likely, when I look at it, it's probably really about the sweet spot where you start to have that tipping point and it just really shoots up. But the reason I brought this article up, the reason I want to talk about this article is because the thing I like most about this study is the huge data set that tells us, on average, since there were almost 200,000 women and 277 atypical femur fractures occurring, then baseline, there is 1.74 fractures per 10,000 patient years. Now, they tried to use computer models and say, well, look at this. If we use computer models over the course of 5 years, we would save somewhere around between 500 to 800 fractures over 5 years. Or you could say it differently and look a woman straight in the face and say, I have a drug I can give you. It may prevent your fracture that's going to happen in the future, and you'll never know that's actually going to happen because we don't know it's going to happen because we can't predict it. You may get a benefit from this drug and you may not. It does come with some side effects. Probably the worst one is the reflux or the GERD that comes with it, but I think that you meet the criteria for it. And since I'm only going to scan you once, because we don't scan if it's more frequently than every, 10 years, unless the patients are super ridiculously high risk. But because I'm only going to scan you once, here's what I can also tell you about this drug that you may read online. This drug you may read online causes a concern for atypical fractures. But the data tells me that atypical fractures happen 1 in every 5,000 women per year, with a greater risk in those that have been on the drug for 8-9 years. So if you're thinking about starting the drug and you're like, oh, I don't know if there's going to be atypical fracture, well, the risk is pretty low. We're talking, on average, 1 in 5,000 women per year. Whew! On to the next article. And the next article is actually not really an article at all. It is a guideline, and it may win guideline of the year, which is a big statement because yours truly has a guideline coming out pretty soon. But in this guideline from the American Cancer Society, they give a recommendation that is game changing, or at least it should be game changing, for cervical cancer screening. That's not why I want to talk about this guideline. The reason I think that this guideline is so amazing is because they say, and I quote, here we go, all participants were required to disclose financial and non-financial, personal, intellectual, and practice-related relationships and activities related to cervical cancer screening that might be perceived as posing a conflict of interest. Boom, bada bing. That is a game-changing statement right there, and that is what all guidelines should be doing. Before you even get on the board, you have to say, listen, I am an OBGYN, that is a potential conflict of interest. I live next to a drug rep that sells a certain drug. That may be another potential conflict of interest. I have my own individual biases because I wrote the previous guideline, so I tend to believe in the previous guideline statement. That's another bias. It is fascinating, and I love that they did this. But let's get on to what the guideline actually says. This guideline from the American Cancer Society says that the average risk individual should begin cervical cancer screening at age 25. Yes, that's right. You heard me correctly. 25, not age 21, as was recommended way back in the Stone Age of 2012. We are now on to 2020, 8 years later, and the evidence is coming along so nicely. You know what else the evidence says? What the guideline says? Well, it says the other major change was the preferred screening approach is primary human papilloma virus, or otherwise known as HPV testing. Standalone testing for high-risk HPV types every 5 years through age 65. If the FDA-approved primary HPV testing is not available, meaning you work in some super remote place and you can't get the FDA-approved HPV test, well then, HPV and cytology co-testing every 5 years or cytology alone every 3 years is acceptable until you get the HPV test. And now that it's in the guidelines, go to your directors and say, we need this test. It's just a matter of ordering it. I mean, come on, man. Of note, there are currently two primary HPV tests that are FDA approved, but the American Cancer Society is very clear when they say that co-testing or cytology alone should be phased out once full access to primary HPV testing for cervical cancer screening is available without barriers. OMG. They're not only saying, hey, listen, we only want you to do HPV, but they're saying, if you're going to use co-testing or if you're going to use cytology, don't do it for very much longer because we are acknowledging that this is inferior. Oh, wow. The guidance applies to all average risk asymptomatic people with a cervix, including transgender men who still have a cervix. Such individuals should be screened regardless of their HPV vaccination status or sexual history. This is huge. It now starts at age 25. Every 5 years till age 65. It doesn't get much better than that. And I will tell you in my own look at the evidence, this is probably the magic point. I think in my take of the evidence, the magic age is probably around 27 or 28. But how easy is this to remember? 25 to 65 every 5 years, HPV only? I mean, come on. If we're not knocking down the huge stacks of articles that go through the book, well, if they're this, then you do 3 years and then 4 years, depending on the cytology with the HPV. No. HPV, test it, high risk, boom. If it's negative, see you in 5 years. On to the next article. And this next article is probably going to be my last article. And during this particular podcast, I have not talked much about how to read articles. I know that some of the listeners out there say, I love when you talk about how to read articles, or you say what the flaws are in an article and you describe how to look for those flaws, because that's what I want to know. And I know other individuals out there say, I absolutely hate when you talk about how to read articles because that's not what I want to know. Just tell me what the article says and move on with it. It's a no-win situation for me. And when you're a one-man band, when you're just the only trick and pony show around in town, when it's just you, there's no winning here. So if you don't like when I talk about what went wrong in the article and how to look for that wrong finding in an article, then you should just go ahead and fast forward to the end rolling credits, because this is not going to be the article for you. The article is titled Randomized Double-Blind Placebo Control of Intra-Articular Transcapsaicin for Pain Associated with Osteoarthritis of the Knee. This is in Arthritis Rheumatology. This was a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trial of adults age 45 to 80 years of age with x-rays showing chronic osteoarthritis, pain for at least 2 months, and a mean or an average pain score of 5 to 9 on a 0 to 10 scale. With these individuals, they randomized them to one of three groups. Group 1 was 0.5 milligrams of capsaicin intra-articular injection. Group 2 was 1 milligram of capsaicin intra-articular injection, and group 3 was placebo. The primary endpoint was area under the curve for the change from baseline through week 12 in the daily WOMAC pain and walking score. First of all, here's a big red flag that I found, and that is when you look at the results, when you look at what the authors say the results are, they brag about the 24-week outcome, but the primary outcome was the 12-week outcome. That's a first red flag. You see, you can normally report your results as an outcome at the end of the study, and that typically sounds something like, well, the pain at the beginning of the study was 1 or 10. And then we gave the drug, and then the pain at the end of the study when we followed up X many weeks later was this. Or you can report your results as area under the curve. Now, area under the curve is a summary of measurements that or serial assessments over time over the duration of the study. So it would sound something like this. The pain at the beginning of this study was 10, and then at week 6, the pain was a 9, and then at week 8, the pain was an 8, and then week 12 the pain was a 3, and then at week 24 the pain was still a 3. And some will argue, some individuals out there will argue that this format, this area under the curve, better reflects the clinical course of the disease. And they will say, well, looking at a single point in time, just looking at the beginning and the end, it doesn't tell me about the multiple time periods during the patient's course. I mean, maybe, just maybe, there was no benefit of this drug whatsoever, and then all of a sudden at 12 weeks later, it just magically started working. Maybe there was no benefit in the meantime, and unless you do area under the curve, we could actually never know what the real true benefit is under the curve, like what happens during the area under the curve of treatment. And I would tell you that they are correct. They're absolutely right when they say that. But when you look at multiple time periods, it becomes very risky that you will maybe skew the data and say, well, we are going to look at the results at week 12. But then once you get the results, you say, well, look at these shiny results and improved, awesome, amazing results at week 24. Who cares that we powered this study to be week 12? That doesn't really matter. We're not going to necessarily report on that. We're going to try to talk about week 24. Week 24, that's what we're going to talk about. All right, that's enough of this rant on area under the curve and how to find the study. But let's get back to the study at hand. Here we go. As I mentioned, the primary outcome was area under the curve at 12 weeks and not your typical pain scales that we see. It was this at the beginning and this at the end. It was area under the curve. And the author results were, and I quote, "In this study, capsaicin injections provided dose-dependent improvement in knee osteoarthritis-associated pain. Capsaicin, 1 milligram, produced a significant decrease in osteoarthritis knee pain through 24 weeks. Capsaicin, 0.5 milligrams, significantly improved pain at 12 weeks, but the effect was not evident at 24 weeks. And that right there is exactly what I'm talking about. Your primary outcome was 12 weeks, but you read the results and they brag about the results at 24 weeks. It smelled to me like drug company money, and you are correct. Centrexon Therapeutics was the sponsor of the study and controlled the study, and my guess is they manipulated the numbers, because when you go to clinicaltrials.gov, which is one of my favorite things to do, they don't say anything at all about using area under the curve. They just say the difference in pain score. This trial is a scam, I suspect. After all, they were only looking for a 0.4 effect size. When you have a 10-point scale and you power your study to find a minimal clinical difference that we just talked about in the last podcast, when you power your study to find a minimal clinically important difference of 0.4 on a 10-point scale, the annoying thing is that you have to power your study to find what you think is the minimally clinical important difference. And these authors thought, well, we have a 10-point scale. Well, who cares if we go from 9 to 8.6? To me, that would be minimally clinically important. Now, that's what the authors thought, and that's what they powered their study to find. Would the patient actually care about that? If I had an injection and I was going to give it to the patient, I said, listen, I know your pain right now is a 10 out of 10. You're lighting up on fire. But if I give you this injection at 24 weeks, I could, 12 weeks, because that's my end point, at 12 weeks, I could get you down to 9.6. So that's pretty good. What do you think about that? No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. But the authors only thought that the minimal clinical difference, the only difference that they wanted to find here was 0.4. And because they picked such a small change in difference, when you look at the p-value, you will see that the p-value is 0.00001. And that makes you think, wow, look at this. This p-value, it's so impressive. This drug must really work. This drug is just killing it. This drug is awesome. Well, yeah, sure. The drug is awesome. The drug is awesome to beat the minimal clinical difference for which they powered the study for, which was 0.4. So yes, you can say with quite a bit of certainty that it is very likely that this drug actually does a 0.4 difference. The p-value there doesn't tell you anything at all about if the drug gives you, I don't know, a 5-point benefit. It just tells you with reasonable amount of certainty that this 0.4 is a real difference, and it probably is actually real. You can reject the null hypothesis. And when you actually go look at the numbers, when you actually dig through the papers, you will see and you will realize that the individuals that got placebo had a 2-point improvement in their pain scales, and those that got capsaicin injections had roughly a 2.7 improvement in their pain scales. That's a 0.7 difference on a 10-point scale, which blows a 0.4 difference out of the water. But the question is there a minimal clinical important difference for the patient there? Does the patient care about that change? For me, this is a no-go, and I can promise you drug reps will be in your office pushing this. You will hear about it at conferences or maybe even from your colleagues who will say, did you hear about the hot new thing? Did you hear about the capsaicin injections? You know, I've had some patients that have had a lot of success with this. Well, of course you had, because if you gave patients placebo injections, you'd have some with a lot of success with this. This is an article that needs to be dropped in the trash right along with the 0.5 milligrams and the 1 milligram capsaicin injections. And with that, let's close up this podcast like we've closed every one before it. From the top, the articles we have talked about so far today is that if you're going to do a DEXA scan once, do it once, and likely for the majority of patients, unless they're incredibly high risk, don't do it again, and certainly don't do it again within 3 years. What about if you're going to start a medication, you're like, oh, I don't know, it's a bisphosphonate, and I heard on board tests that there's atypical femur fractures that occur with bisphosphonates. Well, rest easy, my friends, rest easy. It only happens, or it is more likely to happen, I should say, in individuals that have been on the medication for longer, and even then, it's exceedingly rare. One in every 5,000 women years. Whew! There is a new guideline out there from the American Cancer Society, and they do a great job on pretty much all aspects of it, but the real take-home that you need to know is starting at 25, every 5 years, till age 65, HPV only. And if you have to do cytology, you have to do cytology because you can't use HPV testing. Well then, order HPV testing, and as the authors say, as they say, cytology testing should be phased out. There you have it. They said it straight from the horse's mouth. And last but not least, what if you just want to take some capsaicin, you want to inject it in the knee, and then you're going to have a drug rep that says, look at these great results we have at 24 weeks, even though the primary outcome they were looking for was at 12 weeks, and even though that they powered the study to only find a 0.4 change. So when you look at the p-value, it's going to be super positive. You're like, oh, it's so positive. But realistically, it's only positive because it was a 0.4 change. And the real change, when you actually look at the numbers, there's only a 0.7 change. Ay-yi-yi, come on. This study isn't worth it. This is not the answer to osteoarthritis. They do want it to be the answer, but it is not the answer to osteoarthritis. And with that, I will end this podcast as I've ended every podcast before it. Until next time, keep the quest and questioning.